They're worse. You know, in all candor, President Trump is on a lawless rampage.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, an extended conversation with Vermont U.S. Senator Peter Welch. It has been a busy first few weeks of the second Trump administration as the Republican president seeks to remake the U.S. government. With Republicans in charge of the Senate, Democrats in that chamber have few levers to pull. Vermont Senator Peter Welch says the country is staring down a constitutional crisis. We spoke about that and a lot more. Okay, here's our conversation. Senator Welch, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Ian.
So this is our first Congressional Corner conversation since President Trump returned to office, and you fiercely opposed his bid to be reelected. So far, are things better or worse than you expected?
They're worse. You know, in all candor, President Trump is on a lawless rampage. He has told Congress to drop dead when it comes to congressional authority on spending. He's impounded funds. He's fired people who have statutory protection, like the inspector generals. He's fired people at the Department of Agriculture in Vermont who've been there for years when they have some civil service protections. And, you know, the real issue here is this. He won the election. We've accepted that. He's not the candidate I preferred. And he has a right to pursue his agenda aggressively with all the powers of the executive branch. What he doesn't have is any right at all to cross the boundary and do things that are unconstitutional. And that is extremely alarming to me. So I think we're off to a fierce start by the president, where he's showing that the restraint that we expect from our chief executives to stay within the bounds of the executive branch authority, he's not paying any attention to that.
Now, typically, even when the Congress is the same party as the president, the Congress has been keen to protect its own powers. You know, we have separate branches that are co-equal in this form of government. I take it you don't see Republicans who control Congress upholding that right now.
Unfortunately, I don't. I mean, particularly in the House, but the biggest distinction between the House in the executive or the Congress in the executive is on the power of the purse. And the Constitution was designed to give that to the people in Article One, in the Congress, who are closest to the people, particularly the House. All budget bills have to start there. In the past, whether you were Republican or Democratic Congress, both parties would absolutely insist on being the one that had the authority to set the budget. What you've heard Speaker Mike Johnson say, as Trump has disregarded the budget, is that it's not a big deal. And that's a shocking thing to me, because the responsibility each of us has in the Congress is to protect the system of checks and balances and the separation of powers. And that's eroding clearly with the assault by Trump, a very aggressive attack, and by acceding to that so far by the House. And I think it's quite dangerous in the long term for the well-being of our democracy. That's a big issue we face.
Now, I have two follow-up questions related to that. The first is, you know, at some point, if things go the way they usually go, it'll be Democrats who control Washington. So doesn't this set a precedent where your party would be able to act with impunity the way the Republicans have to this point?
It sets a precedent, but it's one we must renounce. You know, this can sound abstract because everyday folks, we're just going about our business and we're trying to pay the bills at the end of the month. But there are major issues in our society and always have been since the founding of our country. And the benefit of having these separate and equal branches of government is that there's no excessive concentration of power in one branch or the other. And it means that we have to find ways to work through difficult challenges and respect our differences and make progress together. you break down that separation of powers, especially with it all going to the executive. And then Donald Trump, when he tweets out these images of him in royal garb and says, I'm the king, he's not kidding. I mean, that's where he's trying to head. So this is very alarming, and it's something that all of us in the Senate have to resist. We have big differences between Republicans and Democrats, but I'd like to see us stand up for the importance of our constitutional system that's absolutely important to all of us.
Now, the third branch, and this is my second follow-up question, the third branch is the judiciary. And you're on the Judiciary Committee, of course. But people on this show have begun discussing the possibility of a constitutional crisis in America, given that the administration is laying the groundwork, it seems, to ignore certain court rulings that it might find inconvenient. Do you see that as where we're headed right now?
I do. I do. As I mentioned, number one, you've got Trump doing overreach. Number two, you've got the House, particularly Speaker Johnson, acceding to an overreach of authority by President Trump. And number three, you have J.D. Vance saying explicitly, we reserve the right to disregard whatever judicial ruling is made. So if you have the court issuing an order against the Trump action, and then Trump refuses to comply with that order, that is the very definition of a constitutional crisis. Obviously, I hope we don't come to that.
Now, here's another question that arises on this show a lot. Because we're here in the Northeast, a lot of the people who are on the congressional corner are Democrats who find themselves out of power right now. What should the average listener do if they don't like what they're seeing right now in terms of a separation of powers or overreach?
Well, I'm hearing from my constituents. You know, here's the thing that's really alarming to me. What I'm hearing from most from Vermonters more than anything else is dismay. They've never seen their government work this way. And also, there's a lot of Vermonters who know people who have gotten these DOGE notices telling people who've been working hard for years and have always gotten positive reviews, you're no longer needed. Your performance is subpar. So, and then the absolute disruption of norms and disregarded norms is creating this sense that a lot of folks have that there's no stable ground underneath their feet. So it's actually, that is the thing that's so dismaying to so many people. And this is why what Trump is doing, I think, is creating so much anxiety. What should people do? You know, we're pushing back in Congress. I think it's really important for people to be explicitly aware of what's going on and talking and pushing back about it. Because when Trump perceives there to be a pushback, he adjusts. You know, he's got these 25% tariffs that are soon to go in. They were supposed to go in a little while ago. The market reacted and went down. Farmers reacted, and that included farmers in the Midwest who were probably, by and large, supportive of Trump's election. But when it came to how hammered they would be with the tariffs, they spoke up. So I think there is an opportunity. I think we need to speak up about the concrete damage that's going to be done with the implementation of some of these policies. But in all candor, we're in a place we've never been before.
Has your office got a handle on how many federal government employees in Vermont have been tossed out by DOGE?
We don't have an accurate count, but we're getting calls every day from folks who are getting hammered. We had many people who were in USAID programs working in Vermont and also working with organizations in Vermont abroad, and they've been wiped out. We've got Department of Agriculture folks who are really helpful to our farmers and our farm community. And we had shocking layoffs, and it's about 12 people, but that's in a small staff. The other thing that we have is the federal government stiffing farmers. I'll give that as the most cruel example, who had signed contracts with the Department of Agriculture about doing practices like putting in solar on their farms to help them save on their energy bill. to do new farm practices that would improve soils and do more carbon sequestration. The farmers put the money up by borrowing it against the promise of the federal government, the contract, to repay them. And now those farmers are getting told we're not paying. And it's breaking a contract. It's got to be illegal. But it's just an outrageous imposition on these farmers, some of whom will not be able to hang in. So there's a kind of lawlessness that is at work in a way that affects really hardworking people who entered into a contract, in this case, these energy contracts, in good faith and put money up, and now we're in financial jeopardy.
So, Senator Welch, obviously Vermont is a border state, and as we talked about a little earlier, President Trump has proposed these sweeping tariffs and then walked it back a little bit. He's also talking about multiple times making Canada the 51st state. And I wonder, at what point do you take comments like that seriously?
I think I've learned to take Trump seriously all of the time. I mean, he's got a pattern. He says things that are provocative and so seemingly out of place that it's like you say, is that a joke, the 51st state, or he's going to run for a third term. But it's a setup for him then moving in the direction that he just said. So, you know, at minimum, the insult obviously is to Canada. And in Vermont, we're so close to Canada. I mean, not just on the border, but there's back and forth. Our kids play hockey there, and the Canadian kids on the border, they play hockey in Vermont. We've got a library in Derby, Vermont, that Derby Line, Vermont, that's half in Vermont and half in Canada. So we're really, really close to the Canadians, and our trade relationship with them is very, very robust. So why would we insult Canada that way, who has been our best friend? And these tariffs are going to hurt Canada, and they're going to hurt Vermont manufacturers and Vermont farmers. We have roundtable and talk about that. And the manufacturers and the farmers said, number one, we'll have to pick up the cost. Number two, we'll have to pass on the cost to the consumers. So these tariffs are going to be a tax on everyday Vermonters and make it tougher for them to pay their bills each month.
Let's move on to another area now. Wondering what you made of the news that Mitch McConnell will leave the Senate and not seek another term.
Well, I was there when he gave his speech, and he served 42 years. And I'd say two things. One is he was an extraordinarily effective Senate leader for the Republicans. And I acknowledge that, and I regret that in some ways. I think what he did when he said that Barack Obama, it was his job to make sure he was a one-term president, I think was really terrible. Number two, I think what he did on the judges and not giving a hearing to President Obama's nominee was really wrong. But as I served with him in the Senate, this is something I do have great respect for. He stood up to Trump on Ukraine. I mean, we're seeing this horrible situation where President Trump has basically flipped the script and started accusing Zelensky of being a dictator and starting the war. And Trump is now praising Putin as though he's the person who's been aggressed against. Mitch McConnell has stood his ground and really has resisted that. And I respect him for him standing by our commitment to Ukraine and seeing the evil of Putin.
What are your early thoughts on the way that the new Senate Majority Leader, John Thune, is running the Senate?
I think he's doing a good job. I mean, from, again, his perspective. But as a senator, I think he, and this is really important, he understands he's got an obligation to maintain the constitutional authority of the Senate, even as he is pursuing, obviously, the Republican agenda. But he's a fair and square person who's the Republican leader. So we have, on a political level, a huge contest because my colleagues in the Republican side are very much supportive of President Trump. I disagree with that. But in terms of the way the Senate functions and how people are treated, he's doing a good job.
So let's talk for a little while, Senator, about the makeup of President Trump's cabinet. And you voted for several of the cabinet nominees. Others in your party in the Senate have effectively opposed all of them as kind of a protest move. So how have you decided how to approach this series of votes?
Well, the most important thing is on these national security positions like the defense secretary that really has a lot to do with the well-being and national security of people. And on the law enforcement and the attorney general appointment, where our constitutional civil liberties are at stake, I've been very, very tough. And, you know, Hegseth, I think, is totally incompetent and unqualified for the job. And Cash Patel at FBI.
Yeah.
And Cash Patel at the FBI, he has an enemies list. Yeah, he is weaponizing the FBI. And Bondi, who's a capable person, she would not move away from being an election denier. And that it was really eroding my trust, any confidence I had that she'd be able to stand up to Trump when he imposed on her the obligation to pursue his retribution agenda. On other appointees where I won't agree with their policies, like the ag secretary, our farmers want to have a functioning ag department. So we have to have somebody doing that job. On housing, it's not the person I would support, but I want our housing community, folks in Vermont who've been working on housing and have an opportunity to weigh in with that person about why it's so important that we do more in housing. So that was kind of the way I approached it.
You know, since you've raised it, let me ask you about housing. I know you were quoted somewhere I read talking about the fact that you thought housing might be an area of some bipartisan agreement in this term. The governor of Vermont often talks about the housing crisis there. So what's the outlook for that priority of yours?
Well, first of all, it has to be bipartisan. There is not a part of our country, whether it's a red state or a blue state, that has the housing it needs. And housing is so unaffordable for folks. So the challenge that we have with housing is not unique to Vermont. I mean, it's brutal in New York. It's brutal in Indiana. It's brutal in Louisiana. So that's why I say it's got to be bipartisan. And in fact, a lot of the problems that we face, you know, the cost of childcare, the cost of housing, the rising cost of healthcare, these are universal problems that face the American people. And it's why Trump actually is missing an opportunity to bring people together and to try to work together, because there are common problems. And if we can make progress on housing, it's going to be beneficial for folks who voted for him and folks who voted for Harris. Now, Tim Scott is the chair of the Housing and Banking Committee, and Elizabeth Warren is the ranking member, and both of them are talking and working together. So my hope is we can actually come up with some legislation that helps locally. But also on housing, it has to be a partnership, because local zoning and regulation is so important to look at carefully to see if it's driving the cost up and impeding our ability to do the one thing that has to be done, and that's build more housing.
And just back to the vote on Attorney General briefly, you did vote against Pam Bondi. What are your concerns about how the Justice Department is going to proceed given Trump's interest in, I don't know, retribution?
Well, this is not a question. I mean, Trump has said what he wants to do, and he's doing what he said he would do, and that is retribution. I mean, first of all, Trump called it, quote, my Justice Department. Second, the moment Bondi got to the AG's office, she set up a so-called weaponization committee. Third, at the FBI, there's been a demand by the Trump administration and Bondi, who ultimately has authority over the FBI and Kit Patel, for all the names of any agent who worked on any of the January 6 cases. And this is absolutely crash morale in the FBI. Because think about it. You're an FBI agent. You've been there 20 years. You show up for work on a given day, and a superior gives you a file to work on. You know, Peter Welch, I was at January 6th, let's say. Well, that FBI agent is just doing his or her assignment. It's not as though they're making a political choice to pursue the investigation. And what has happened under the Trump regime is that he wants names. And it is terrifying because you're essentially making people victims of this illegal, I think totally inappropriate investigation just because they did their job. So it's quite damaging. And, you know, we need a strong FBI to help keep us safe.
So, Senator Welch, we're speaking just after this all-night vote in the Senate for the budget and the Republican budget, a $340 billion plan. And that, of course, would have to be reconciled with whatever the House does. There is a looming funding deadline for the government also coming up. So what do you think about the package that your colleagues put forward?
It's terrible. The heart of the Trump agenda is this so-called budget plan. And it's not really about a budget. It's really about a tax cut. And agenda item 1, 2, and 3 for Trump is to lower taxes. And the taxes he wants to lower are for folks who are billionaires, by and large, and for major international corporations whose profits are at record highs. And that's one thing. And there'll be some tax cut which that we support, by the way, for middle class and lower income people. We're all on board on that. But the billionaire tax cut, two things. One, it adds to the deficit and doesn't improve economic prosperity. But number two, it is intended to be paid for. How? By taking away health care from people who get it, oftentimes on Medicaid. And that's a lot of older people. You know, in Vermont, 2 out of 3 older folks who are in nursing homes, their beds are paid for by Medicaid. They could get evicted. It's a lot of kids who are in low-income families who could lose Medicaid. You know, so this is a real threat to the well-being of people who are hanging on by their fingernails or are in nursing homes and wouldn't have a way of paying for that. So that's the big challenge here. They're trying to hide that fact that and Trump is really lying about this. He's saying he's totally for Medicaid, but then he endorsed the House bill that guts Medicaid in the way I just described. So here's the question. You want to trade tax cuts for billionaires and millionaires in exchange for gutting Medicaid that is so important to the well-being of so many people in all of our states.
Senator, we've talked a lot on this show about your issues with the U.S. Postal Service in recent years and its leader, DeJoy. Now there's news that he's leaving, but with that, President Trump wants to take over oversight of USPS. So what are your expectations for what that might mean?
I have no idea what that would mean. You know, when Trump says these things, there's nothing behind it. It's just a pronouncement. So what it means, I don't know. But, you know, my response to DeJoy going was good riddance.
Yes, your statement was only 2 words.
Yeah, no, it was a real problem in Vermont. You know, we had the floods in July of 2023 and 2024. And we went in the post office in Montpelier, our capital city, was wiped out. And we went for over 14 months before we got the bare bones replacement post office. But moreover, DeJoy disregarded efforts by the governor, by the local leaders in Montpelier, by Senator Sanders and me, and Congresswoman Ballin. We would call. They wouldn't answer. And it was an astonishing disregard for people who lost their post office due to a flood. So we got such bad service from him that I lost confidence. And I hope that, whoever the replacement is, I think can only be an improvement.
Let me follow up on another issue we've talked a lot about on this show, and that is FEMA. Vermont has had, as you just mentioned, its share of emergencies and recovery efforts in recent months and years. You had actually an op-ed that I read about how you'd like to see FEMA be reformed going forward. So what would you like to see?
Well, first of all, I absolutely don't want to see it destroyed. And my op-ed piece in the New York Times was in response to Donald Trump saying, why don't we just get rid of FEMA? Well, that's a catastrophe. It would be for any community around the country that is in the path of one of these natural disasters, a fire, floods in Vermont, floods in North Carolina, tornadoes in Oklahoma, hurricanes in Louisiana. And our experience in Vermont with FEMA is they're really good in the immediate aftermath of the storm. They come in and have logistical capabilities, experienced emergency responders who actually help communities get through the worst of the storm. But then the second part is the long-term recovery. And where this is where FEMA gets super bureaucratic, and it's very frustrating. A family who has had their home destroyed can't get an answer on whether they get a buyout or for how much. A business gets to run around when it comes to whatever loan they're entitled to get back on their feet. Farmers who are waiting for crop insurance don't get it. Select boards that do so much to repair the local infrastructure don't get an answer on whether they can use a 20-inch culvert or a 10-inch culvert. So my proposal is that when it comes to the longer-term recovery, you give much more power to the local community. And that means you let the local officials make a lot more decisions and have access to the resources to fix that culvert, to do the buyout. Much more local control and local leadership in the long-term recovery.
What does it mean if the Department of Education is shuttered?
It creates chaos because there's a number of programs that the Education Department is involved in that affect all of our school districts in New York and in Vermont and all around the country. So this is sort of the typical way that Trump is proceeding, you know, shoot first and aim after. So that's a real disruptor.
I have just enough time left for one more question. And, you know, I'm thinking back on conversations we had last year when you saw President Biden's very shaky debate performance. And, you know, you were one of the first in your party to take the stand to say that Biden should step aside and, you know, the Democrats should find another candidate. And we know how the election turned out. Now that your party is in the wilderness to a degree in Washington, who do you look to as kind of the leader of the Democrats right now? And what do you think the party should be doing ahead of the next vote in 2026 to come back?
Well, two things. We don't have a party leader yet. That'll emerge in time. And I think we have to really resist the overreach by Trump and his attack on the constitutional order, really resist and expose what he's doing in the judicial side with our law enforcement at the FBI and at the Justice Department. If that gets weaponized and it's vengeance tour, that's so damaging to our country. Second, I think there's got to be some self-reflection on the Democratic Party. You know, we have to be much more relatable and less preachy and reach out to folks who are having trouble paying their bills and working hard and reconnect with the folks that we've tried to serve over the years. And that's everyday, average, hardworking Americans.
All right. That does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.